Requesting connection. Established. Encrypted. We're live. The show you've been asking for. Advice, technology, and community. Linux first, all others second. This is Ask Noah.
Live from AltaSpeed Technologies, the Ask Noah show starts right now. This is the show where we came to do all the things on Linux they said couldn't be done and take your questions on how to do the same. The phone lines are open this hour. To be a part of the program, it is a free call, 1-855-450-NOAH. It's 1-855-450-6624. Send an email to live at AskNoahShow.com. My name is Noah Chalaya. I am your host. Delighted to be here with you as another episode of the Ask Noah Show kicks off this hour. Joining me, my co-host, Mr. Steve Ovens. Welcome in, sir.
Good evening, Noah. How it goes?
I love Christmas time, Steve. It's Merry Christmas. I'm so happy that we're getting up to Christmas time. We got 1 week left. Next week's Christmas. I've been playing Christmas week all week this week on the radio. It's a good week.
You know, my wife was disappointed because we haven't been getting the cold, because it doesn't feel like Christmas because it's not been, minus 20 outside.
Yeah. I don't care about the cold so much. That can come or go as long as I have snow. I need snow on Christmas Eve. It has to be a white Christmas. It's not a brown Christmas. It's not a green Christmas. It's a white Christmas. Bing Crosby was very clear.
Yeah. Yep. Well, we're still waiting for white here. We got a bit of snow. It froze over and then the snow blew away. So not really sure what to do with that.
I'll tell you what we do with that. We dig into feedback and answer people's Linux and open source questions. That's what we do with that. Our first email comes in from John. John writes in and says, "Hi guys. First off, I love the show. I've been listening for a while and I'm still binging trying to catch up. Anyway, in episode 351, Steve was looking for a solution for connectivity while working in the garden. He should just get one of those cheap Chinese watch phones that you can put a SIM card in. My kids have them, so I can call them if I can't see them from the window. They simply take a SIM card and you receive SMS. They're cheap. But if he's not wanting to take a device in case it gets damaged, then maybe a 15-euro garden watch could be a solution. Anyway, regards from the not-so-sunny Scotland." So, Steve, I can only imagine the look on your face. The steam coming out of your ears if somebody is suggesting another mobile phone. So not one mobile phone, but two mobile phones. You can have a high-risk mobile phone and a low-risk mobile phone.
I wouldn't exactly say steam coming out of my ears, but I'd say that John doesn't have the good history that you and I have had over my...
And the FedEx lady.
...disdain for these things, for anything that has a SIM card.
Steve doesn't do phones.
No, I don't really do phones. I do phones under duress. But on top of that, like, the idea here is if I can get like a Bluetooth range extender, then my watch isn't really tracking where I'm going. It just happens to be getting a ping from my phone, which is sitting on the desk, which is where it lives 99% of its life. So if I have something on me that's connecting to towers and stuff like that, that's just not something I just go without before I would put something more tracking on my body.
Right. Just ask the UPS lady or FedEx, which was it?
Yeah. Yep.
So try again. I guess here's the bottom line. So I know what he's talking about with these cheap phones. They're actually really cool. So I bought one. I have a different use case. You might appreciate, even if you don't particularly care for phones, you'll appreciate the authority that I'm trying to usurp here. So with my children, the school system has these rules about having phones. Now, from their perspective, or the way they present it anyway, it's to keep the children focused on the tasks at hand. Things like the iPads that we give them in third grade or the laptops we give them. And so they don't want them using their own phones or their own laptops. The school will give them the distractions, or excuse me, the electronics to use during the class. So my thing is, if there's some sort of an emergency incident, if there was some sort of violent outbreak at my child's school, I would want to know immediately, and I would want the opportunity to go find the nearest meeting place to go collect my children and remove them from said situation, and then the school and the police department and everybody else can deal with the situation as they see fit. I just want my kids out first. And so I have these phones are really great for that because they're tiny, so they're practically undetectable, and they're no use from a distraction benefit because you can't download apps and you can't the ones that I have anyway, you can't even text on them. It's literally like a little monochrome one-line display, and you can peck out a phone number and hit a button and make a voice call, and that's it. But from my standpoint, they actually work really cool, and they've got little ones that are as small as a pen. They've got some that'll fit inside of your sock. So it's like you pretend you're James Bond, Steve, and then it's pretty cool.
I mean, I see the utility in it. I don't know. Again, I balance the idea of there may be some natural disaster sometime in the future with trying to instill the fact that we shouldn't have devices on us at all times.
Here's the other side of it. If I woke up in your shoes and I had everything hosted at my house and everything set up the way I wanted it, my only remaining challenge was, well, I'm going to be about 250 feet that away instead of 200 feet this away. I probably wouldn't opt for another monthly expense to achieve that, right? Like, you have access points. You have wireless coverage. You don't need to rent it from the cell phone company.
Yep, it's just simply a matter of I don't carry my phone. So this is a completely solvable problem with, it's like, you know, get a pouch, stick the phone in the pouch, put the pouch on your back or something like that. Like, it's a solvable problem. It's just...
You're an obstructionist.
Well, I mean, it seems like there should be an answer to this. Like, I shouldn't have to carry my phone. Somebody's probably like, hasn't somebody thought this through before? I guess maybe not. Maybe people are just like, nah, just carry your phone.
I think we're moving more towards that direction, not away from that direction, if I was to hazard a guess. But for the weather record, I'll be right there with you and we can be in your backyard phoneless together. And it will be fun. Like, I would. I'll buy onto that. I'm totally good. And I've extracted myself from phonism. I'm a laptop guy. Works with what I do naturally. So it's fine. Our second email comes in from Jeremy. Jeremy writes in and says, Noah and Steve, that's us, I had some feedback about this episode regarding kid-friendly distros. What I have learned with my six-year-old son is that screens and computers are too addictive for this age, and that generally kids will be healthier with more time spent on analog things like people and toys and building blocks and books, coloring, etc. There was a period I would let my son play video games on the weekend, and so he would pester me all week and all weekend. Then on the weekend, he would simply move on to the computer or go to the restroom. So for us, it was decided it was just not a healthy behavior. Instead, if we'll play games, we'll go out together, or we'll go bowling, or do Funland. Regarding the content filtering topic, however, I found luck with running PFSense and PFBlocker NG. I use a Netgate appliance that's running it. It has a null DNS list on the web. They also have an option to use DNS CNAMEs to force a safe search in Google and YouTube. Another neat feature is the block public DNS servers list. There's a Canadian guy that has a nice set of blacklists. I add to what PF Blocker comes with out of the box, which is github.com/clevenblack/hosts. There are a number of different categories and unsavory sites that you can block. So essentially, I have a pie hole plus a firewall plus content filtering in a small appliance. If you didn't have a prosumer firewall, didn't want to build your own desktop, you might check out Netgate. There's a bunch of other neat things that they have, like LTE, Wi-Fi, WAN support, VPN, Tailscale Daemon, etc. Hope this helps. Best, Jeremy. So, Steve, he's in your boat as far as electronics and kids, but some really cool suggestions here in the way of content filtering.
Yeah, I wonder whether or not this would work with DNS over HTTPS or not. Like, is that going to block, like, is there some way around it? Like, there's some way around it if you go and edit your resolver or whatever your local DNS lookup is, because if you're basically nulling out any of the publicly accessible DNS routes. But does that apply to the Firefox, DOE, as it's called? I'm not sure.
I'll tell you what, firsthand experience, I tried to go away from YouTube, and I can tell you is, I was less than successful trying to do it through DNS. Encrypted DNS is a pain if your goal is to control DNS. Now, I suppose there could be an option for encrypted DNS and then you control the DNS that it encrypts and talks to, right?
Well, that's what I mean. Like, the encrypted DNS just simply has a query in it, but it still has to have an IP. Like, that's the way TCP works.
Yes.
So if you nulled out, like, just don't allow access to these IPs, would it still work? I'm not sure. I guess it'd be a valid test case that I just haven't done.
1-855-450-NOAA. It's 855-450-6624. The email live at asknoahshow.com. I'm going to pull Atypical into our on-air room and Mumble. You can join mumble.minddrip1.com. So yeah, Micah writes in and says, where do you guys see the state of Linux smartphones now coming from? The Ubuntu Touch, Pinephone, Librem 5, etc. hype has mostly died off. Is the future of secure smartphones just continuing to de-Googlify Android with the likes of EOS and Lineage? Do you know of anyone who truly daily drives Linux? Not to put a wet blanket on it, but I'm not seeing a general excitement of progress happening. For Linux on mobile, like we did around 2 years ago, I know that supporting hardware with all of the mobile being a bunch of SoCs is difficult, but all the truly supported phones are like 7 years old at this point. I have two Pine phones, and they're doing great, but they lack the general usability for day-to-day lack of polish on call quality, battery life, etc. Would love to know what you guys think, and would like to wish you a very Merry Christmas to you and all your listeners. Well, thanks, Micah. So I'll start by saying this. The reality is that all of these open source smartphone alternatives are coming onto the scene 10 years behind the curve, right? So you had Android, you have iOS. Everybody talks about Apple being the first smartphone. It wasn't. Palm OS was around long before Apple was a thing. So there's been a slow evolution of smart devices and integrating them into phones. And so Linux and open source is kind of coming to that game late, so to speak, if you don't count Android as part of Linux. Here's the reality that I came to. When you're talking about a security perspective, you're eventually starting from the standpoint that you have instruction sets that talk to all of these devices via drivers. And it turns out most of these systems are using Android as the system to talk to all of the hardware anyway. And so even in stuff like Selfish OS, it's a totally different operating system. It's Linux. It has all the beautiful things, but the way that it's talking to the hardware is still through, you know, an Android shim of sorts. And so you start to wonder, what is really the advantage of having all of this other stuff packed behind that if at the end of the day it's coming to translating to Android, or at least that's how we interact with the hardware? And that's what makes some of the things like Lineage and others, so, or Graphene OS, so attractive, is that they start from the premise of, okay, so we know we're going to use Android to talk to these things. So now let's just go about the business of making that as secure as humanly possible. And then let's backport the steps that we need to backport in order to enable us to do the things that we do on Android. So I'm going to open this up to first, Steve, do you have any thoughts on where you see this going? And then I'm also going to bring Atypical into this.
So I echo your sentiments about the Linux versions of operating systems being behind. Essentially, that's what happens when you're not the one out innovating. And there's obvious reasons for that. And that's just going to be the way that open source is in general. When it's not leading, it has catch up to do, and eventually it will achieve parity as the other ones slow down, or you might get a new feature. But generally speaking, it's always going to be behind the curve, and that's just something that you're going to have to live with.
Mm-hmm.
When you start talking about alternative ROMs like Lineage, or probably less Lineage, but more specialized things like Graphene OS, which I like a lot. I've been using it for 5 months, something like that. Noah finally convinced me when my other phone got EOL'd by Google to put Graphene on. I've been running into little niggles that I can't get around because of the way that the app is doing detection. So for whatever reason, of all of my apps, the Marriott app will not work. It launches and then crashes because it's like you've rooted your phone and it just dies. And there's a few other apps that have that do the same thing. I found stuff reported on the forum for the exact same error. And it just boils down to the programmers don't know what they're looking for. Mm. And obviously, for people that don't know, Graphene OS is not rooted. That's the whole point. It is a secure phone that happens to implement like sandboxing between applications. But there's no way for me to get around that in terms of using the phone. And for me, I just shrug and be like, it's a phone. It's half useless to me anyways. And I pull out my laptop. But for other people that have heavy reliance on their phone, I would caution you to say, I really like them. I think you should continue to support them. But it's not going to be a smooth experience, because just like Linux in the early aughts, you're going off the beaten track and you're going to have people that don't understand what's happening, that you'll be misdiagnosed or whatever. And so just be warned that you're in for an adventure if you go down that route.
100%. So we're going to talk a little bit more about Postmarket OS coming up later in the show. So stick around for that. Atypical, I know you have a lot of experience in this space. Where do you see the current state of Linux on the smartphone?
Yeah, so a few things. One, you were mentioning about how a lot of the Linux mobile OSs use an Android shim to talk to the hardware. Well, that is true for some of them. There are some that do talk directly to the modem. And in the case of the PinePhone, and I believe the PinePhone Pro, you can actually take and load an open source firmware onto the modem. So you can actually get pretty far with completely like zero Android. The Librem 5, I know there's efforts there to decouple from any kind of Android shim and get open source firmware blobs on everything as well.
How many of those phones could you use on a day-to-day basis? Like replaces your daily driver that would have similar performance to a, you know, off-the-shelf Samsung or Pixel or iPhone?
So I would say that they're not currently there as of today. And one of the things to take into account is the fact that the hardware, so primarily the PinePhone, PinePhone Pro, and Librem 5 are the big ones in the arena, if you will. Those phones, if you look at their hardware spec, are essentially a bottom-of-the-barrel Android phone. And bottom-of-the-barrel Android phones don't run Android well. So there's that to take into account. They barely run Android, especially the new versions. The other thing is that while there hasn't been a lot of necessarily hype, there is still a very steady, constant churn and constant improvements to Linux on mobile phones, both in the driver space and the software space. And so we're getting more and more apps and more optimizations. And there are some people out there who have daily driven the PinePhone Pro or the Librem 5,
yeah,
and they made it work.
Yeah, no doubt.
So I think where it's going to go in the future is at some point, whether it be the Pine folks or Librem or who knows, maybe Canonical will come out with another phone, we're going to get a Linux phone that has a significant bump in the hardware spec. And at that point, we may actually get a fully daily driver.
That'd be cool.
I think the issue is that the current phones are just underpowered. Not so much that the software isn't there, because we're almost feature parity as far as the software goes. It's just the oomph in the device.
Yeah. I appreciate you joining us. I would say that I think there, even when you take like hardware and load an alternative system onto it, I think there are still maybe some growing pains in the way of things like navigation, and certain apps that are available or not available. I think that app ecosystem is really where what we're talking about when we say like they have 10 years of experience that Linux just is having to catch up with. So I think it's fine for tinkers. I think it's a great idea, Micah. I think it's something that definitely a space to play around in. I have a PinePhone. I play with it from time to time. I'm real excited with what Postmarket OS is doing, specifically with KDE Posh. Looks fantastic. I used for the first time at scale this year, I picked up a KDE Mobile and I was like, I thought it was a skin for Android. That's how responsive for that was. So no doubt about it, we're making progress. I just think we're a long ways away from the average person being able to pick it up, or even the demanding nerds being able to pick it up and use it as a day-to-day device. I think you have to be committed from a philosophical standpoint, not so much a practical, like, I just want something to get something done. Sandro writes in and says, hi there, I'm considering a little homeland setup based on ZFS and KVM and NixOS for both the host and the VMs. NFS for access to application data through a WireGuard tunnel. What's your suggestion for databases? Currently, I have each VM on a disposable QCOW2 file for the OS and another QCOW2 file mounted to varlib Postgres to the VM. Some VM is a single application, so the DB is dedicated. The VM has multiple applications, so the DB cluster is shared. Do you suggest having simpler VMs with less QCOW2 files on a single Postgres cluster served over TCP. Thanks for the great value that you provide. So, Steve, if you woke up in Sandro's shoes, what would you be looking at as a way to host your database?
So in this particular case, I almost always store my Varlib Postgres stuff outside of the VMs. We've kind of been over this a bunch. If you wanted to take advantage of ZFS snapshots and stuff like that, I might pass in the VDev, pardon me, right into the VM so that the host still has the Postgres files on them, as opposed to going with another QCow file. You know, you and I kind of talked about this last week about how I'm sort of opposed to a QCow file for storing the data as a general rule, just because you've got a file system, then you create a sparse file, then you put a file system inside the sparse file, then you put files on top of that. And I'm not exactly sure what that gets you when you could just pass in the VDev or a block device or what have you. So maybe there's something out there that I'm not familiar with, that I'm not seeing, but that's what I would do.
Lastly, Elgato Eero, hope I'm pronouncing that right, writes in via the Geek Lab, you can to /geeklab:linuxdelta.com, and says, Marlon, I need a new home router. I have an old Linksys right now, but the range is worse than the one from my ISP. What's a good one that can run OpenWRT or has good range or can mix and mesh? Not looking to spend, but maybe $100-$150. Used is okay too. So, Steve, do you have a favorite OpenWRT router?
I don't really. I haven't used the WRT routers in a long time. I abandoned the kind of the commercial, like, let's say the ones you go down to Best Buy or whatever. I kind of abandoned those routers, I don't know, a decade ago. So I'm not really up to how well they handle. Back when I was doing it, they would have a hard time. OpenWRT had a hard time on that hardware doing what I needed it to do. So I ended up building a small computer to be the firewall appliance, and I haven't looked back.
I'll shoot you a link to openwrt.org. They have a hardware support page where they'll list every router that will work with OpenWRT, so you can definitely go that route. And if you're just getting started and don't have a lot of networking experience, OpenWRT can be a great gateway into getting a little bit more power features. I'll tell you what I would do if I woke up in your shoes. You said your budget was about $100 to $150, and you can get yourself a really nice router for $100 to $150. What I would do is I would go to eBay and I would look up a Sophos XG135. So I'm looking at one right now on eBay for $128 or best offer. And the thing that I really like about these is it's a routing appliance, but if you take the cover off, it's just a little Intel computer that happens to be outfitted with some really nice network interfaces and labeled for things like WAN and LAN, and has a dedicated serial console port. And of course it has like HDMI and USB, so you can just plug in a regular monitor if you want. But you buy something like this and you install either pfSense or something like OpenSense on it, I think what you'll find is you'll get all of the things that you were hoping to get out of like OpenWRT, but I think you're going to find that you're going to get there with a lot. You're going to have more options, and there isn't going to be significantly more of a learning curve. There's a lot of tutorials out there, and it will really put you into a place where you can really take control of your home network. If you don't want to tinker with any of the advanced stuff, you certainly don't have to, but when you go looking, it'll be there for you.
From the Linux Newswire newsroom, this is the Week in Review with JT.
For the week of December 17th, 2023, here's the Linux and open source news. KubeOS 4.2 has been released and has rebased DOM 0 to Fedora 37. Speaking of Fedora, Fedora Asahi Linux 39 is out. The Manjaro team has announced the release of version 23.1, codenamed Vulkan. Postmarket OS 23.12 has been released to breathe new life into smartphones. Calamari's installer version 3.3 is out. Shotcut 23.12 has been released. Ardour 8.2 is out. Pzip 9.6 is out. GNUcache 5.5.5 has been released. GNOME 44.7 is out. And the Firefox team has released version 121, which on Ubuntu 23.10 will open in Wayland mode. A preview of Windows AI Studio has landed, a set of tools and models from catalogs, including Azure AI Studio and Hugging Face. However, it only runs on Linux at the moment. And lastly, in security news, The complex NK abuse malware uses blockchains to hide on Linux and IoT machines. The multifaceted malware leverages the NKN blockchain-based peer-to-peer networking protocol, operating as both a sophisticated backdoor and a flutter launching DDoS attacks.
SSH, it's long been considered incredibly secure, immune from most attacks, and yet a new attack is upon us. It's called Terrapin, and it's a new hack that works when an attacker has an active man in the middle position, that is to say, can intercept the traffic between you and the box that you're trying to SSH into. What's interesting about this is, before anybody panics, it's a fairly complicated tactic to pull off, from the standpoint that you have to be using a specific form of encryption with either CHA-CHA-20, Poly-1305, or CBC with Encrypt Then Mac, both of which were cipher modes that were added to the SSH protocol in 2012 and 2013, which is of note because SSH long predates 2012 and 2013. But a scan by researchers found that 77% of servers that are on the internet are using one of those vulnerable encryption modes. And because of that, this is a real problem. So at its core, Terrapin works by altering or corrupting the information that's transmitted through the SSH stream during the handshake, the earliest possible stage when the connection is negotiating between the two parties. And those encryption parameters, then they use to establish a secure connection. So the attack is specifically targeting what's known as BPP, or known as the Binary Packet Protocol, which is designed to ensure that adversaries with an active position can't drop messages exchanged during the handshake. So Terrapin then relies on the prefix truncation, which is essentially a class of attack that removes the specific messages at the beginning of the data stream. There's a really, really fantastic write-up on it on Ars Technica, which you can we'll have linked in the show notes if you want to read it in its entirety. But this is one of the few attacks that we've ever seen against SSH. So it's a big deal. And it exploits some weaknesses, again, in those specific encryption modes. So if you don't have those modes, or if you're not in a position to where somebody can get into a position to perform a man-in-the-middle attack, you're less likely to have a problem. But we thought we'd draw some attention to it and have it available and at least bring some attention in. So if you're running those modes of SSH, that you're aware of them and you're patching them. Steve, do you use SSH open to the internet, or is everything you have behind a firewall of sorts?
That's a good question. I think largely I'm behind a firewall. There used to be a time where I had to have a backdoor open in the event that, something like the whatever VPN software I was using at the time wasn't working. But now with Tailscale and OpenVPN running on my outside router, I haven't really had the need to expose anything to the internet like that.
I'm in a mixed boat. So I absolutely have stuff that's open to SSH on the internet. And largely I have gotten lucky, I guess. I've been told you're stupid if you expose SSH to the internet, but I've largely not seen a whole lot of attacks. And then to add to that, again, even in this case, while it's still technically possible, it requires the right combination of encryption and the right positioning of the attacker, which, again, depending on, I suppose, what you're defending against, maybe that's important to you, maybe it's not. But be aware of it. Be aware that it's out there. And if you're using either of these two security models, CHA-CHA-20 or Poly-1305 or CBC with Encrypt Then Mac, then I would probably look into doing it otherwise. EMS, Element Matrix Services, they are the commercial company behind Matrix. So there's Matrix, the organization that makes the protocol and does the work and gave us Element and the Matrix communication system. Element, specifically then, or EMS, is the company that then takes that and tries to turn it into a commercial product. So when they launched, they did turn it into a commercial product that was a hosted Element instance. And at that time, they told people, well, Slack costs X amount of dollars a month. We're only charging, this month. So we're less than Slack and you can own all of your communications. Well, that sales pitch landed very well with me. And so not only did I sign up with my own business, but I convinced every business owner that would listen to me, hey, if you're relying on communications, don't be like the software companies that have highly sensitive information walk out the front door via a Slack channel because you weren't able to verify identity. You should be running Element. And if you don't want to be on a public instance, here's a company that you can support, the company who makes Element. And oh, by the way, they'll provide this hosting service for you. So I did that and a lot of people signed up and it's been going very well. And to EMS's credit, I haven't had any problems. I mean, the instance has largely just worked. Well, it turns out that you can't sell per user, because what ends up happening is you might have five users, but if they're on an instance that's federated and somebody joins, Matrix HQ, well, now you have 10,000 some users that are all exchanging images and videos and pictures and whatever else. And you're keeping retention for that for the entire room because your server is federated there and you have one user in that room. So now the entire room becomes federated to your server. So now you're tracking all of that. And it doesn't take a whole lot of imagination to figure out how these servers would just mushroom out of control. So EMS sent a notice out, and I'm not sure how I feel about it. Dear Noah, we're writing to inform you that we're discontinuing our consumer hosting products and legacy plans. Therefore, your current subscription for your home server will come to an end. If you want to keep your service, you can either upgrade to Element Business subscription with a reduced minimum user, see below, which they reduce it from 50 to 20, which means that my hosting cost would go to only $1,200 a year. To put that into perspective for you, I was paying, I believe, somewhere on the order of like $158 for one of my instances and about $362 a year for the other instance. And we're going to go from that to $1,200 an instance. All of the entity, my personal entity, my company, all the things I had together were $640 was the grand total. And we're going to go to $1,200 per instance per year. And oh, by the way, you pay them for the entire year up front. But they'll cut you a break because they'll cut it down to 20 users instead of 50. So at least it's only $1,200. That's your first option. Here's your second option. If you have a custom domain, you can download a copy of your data and migrate it to a Matrix hosting provider or host your own home server. Alternatively, if you're no longer interested in the service, you can just let it cancel. Okay, great. So here's the issue I have. Issue number one. I was billed for my yearly hosting service back in October, meaning that I should be good through October of 2024. So in October of 2024, if EMS would like to change the model to which they've entered an agreement with me, that seems like that would be okay. But I kind of feel like I'm getting the rug pulled out from under me 3 months into my next year's agreement. That's number one. Here's number two. Of all the people that are probably hosting Element or paying Element for hosting, I have to believe we're darn near the bottom of needy users. We know how to troubleshoot all of the client-side things ourselves. And so really the only thing we've ever needed from them is the actual server, which I opened one support case one time because I went to do the server upgrade and they have a little button that says upgrade to new version and it failed. But it came back within a few minutes and then it was fine and I updated them. So nobody from support even actually got involved. So I don't think we're one of the squeaky wheels to begin with. Apart from that, again, I feel like I've kind of stuck my neck out. Steve was telling me it's the early adopter tax to stick your neck out and say, hey, go do this thing. And now all of these businesses are looking back at me going, well, we signed up for this thing. They said they were going to do it. And now apparently we're not doing it. What's going on? Here is their answer. And I haven't heard this from EMS despite reaching out not once, not twice, but three different times to reach out to say, hey, I'd really like to understand this better. But based on their website, here's what I have put together. And again, I'm open to correction. I just can't find anybody to answer some of these questions. So Element.io releases what they call the Element Starter Open Source Edition. And so Element Starter, their words, is a game changer offering as free, as in beer, self-hosted version of the Element Server Suite. It's a lightweight version of the officially supported Kubernetes-based components found on our paid packages, Business, Enterprise, and Sovereign, the very same stack used to power the biggest Matrix instance home servers in the world and built by the same team who created Matrix. Element Starter is ideally suited for small deployments of up to 200 users. It ships out of the box with perfectly orchestrated sliding sync proxy, support for instant login, launch, and sync, Matrix authentication service for native OIDC authentication, Element call for native scalable video, and all the other things. Okay, so what I take from this is that Element Starter is They're managing the instance, but you give them the server to manage the instance on. So far as I understand it, if you go download the Element server suite, you install it on a server, and then you log into your EMS account, and you're able to do everything you were able to do with the EMS instance, you're just paying for the server. So, and I can't qualify this enough, if I understand this right, which I don't necessarily assume I do, but if I understand this correctly, I get what Matrix or what EMS is after here, because they're offloading the cost mechanism of the server. So if you do have a home server that's blown up to some monstrosity, that's on you. But they're not just going to cut people off the knees and say, if you just wanted an easy way to get your own instance up and running and you don't know about Postgres and setting up databases and setting up sliding sync and Nginx proxies and all that, just find yourself a VPS and run this little script and then log into your EMS account and say deploy server. I think that's how it works. I would like to get confirmation from somebody from Element. So if you're listening to this, reach out to your boy. I'm trying to help, but I'm in the dark. But the other part of it is that there's no support with this. So it's free up to 200 users. That part's great. Offload it so that they're not going bankrupt because you're going to buy your own server. That part's great. Give me access to the orchestration stuff so that the people who know how to set it up best are doing the setup. That part's great. The part where I'm left with huge, gigantic question marks is the following. If I use this Element server suite, am I responsible for the server? If I'm responsible for the server, I want to know how it's set up. How did we do this? Additionally, if I'm going from EMS, how am I supposed to know what kind of server I'm supposed to rent? How much data is there? How much retention is there? How many rooms are joined? I don't have access to any of that information. All I can see is the little portal from EMS that, and now this fancy little notice that tells me that they're going to shut it off in a few months. But past that, I have no idea what's sitting at the other end. So those are questions that I need, that I would need to be answered. And mind you, I'm a fairly technical user, so I'm capable. I run my own home server apart from my business instance. I guess I'm going to start running another one. So if I know that path and I've gone that path and I've walked down that path and I know where the bones are buried down that path is, I wonder what the business owner who just blindly signed up and said, okay, I want to trust sovereign data and I want to own my own data and all of that and just blindly jumped on the bandwagon. How does that person feel and what are they staring at? So if that's you and you're in this boat, reach out to us, altaspeed.com/contact, fill out the contact form, let us know that you're in trouble. We'll help you land on a solution and we're going to work with EMS. We'll have to work with EMS to get our own instance sorted out and we'll gladly help other people land there as well, if that's something that you find you need some help with. Here is what I think the positive sides of this are. A, the positive side is I do like this idea of they manage and you just have, because I think it opens other people up to having in their own instances on Matrix. Yes, I think if the administration is going to fall on me, that I probably need a little bit, I need to be privy to a little bit more of what's going on underneath the hood. But at the end of the day, I will just use Matrix Ansible Deploy, and then that's kind of a solving problem. But here's the other thing that comes up. The other thing that comes up is blacklists. So this is something we've been fighting on the Linux Delta server, is that you have spam and moderation, and the answer to that is to use blacklists. And effectively what it is it's a bot that goes around and kicks users out that say bad things and then adds them to a list that everybody else watches. Well, the problem is Linux Delta, for whatever reason, has been added to that list. There are 10,000 users on that server. I have absolutely no earthly idea what all 10,000 of them do. Heck, I probably only know 7 of the people that are on that server. But at the end of the day, somebody did something stupid, and so we've gotten blacklisted from matrix.org. Sounds like it shouldn't be that big of a problem, right, Noah? Wrong. Because now I can't federate to other servers because they're all following these blacklists, to include some of the servers that I'm paying for. So there, it's not exactly a walk in the park running it yourself. One of the advantages of having EMS do this is that they kind of help out, and they'll manage the ban list and federation and deal with all those issues and stuff like that. So I can see where there's some positives that they're going to extend that for free to people, so it will allow people to get off the ground easier. But I also think there's some pitfalls there as well. And finally, the people that I think are really getting screwed here are the Element One folks. So these are people that signed up for the little mini home server where you get your own tiny little instance, but you can use it up to 5 users or something like that. And I think it started where they charge $5 and then maybe there was some other thing where it wasn't. But in any event, I have my own server, so I'll just take my server signing key and I'll move it somewhere else and life will go on. It'll be fine. But if you were an EMS One user, your Matrix ID is tied to a server that they're going to kick you off of. And you can't take that with you. And oh, by the way, portable identities aren't done yet, so you're just going to have to invite a new user to all of those rooms. Granted, they have an automated tool for doing that, but if I were an EMS-1 user, I just don't feel like I would have a good taste in my mouth. And then last but not least, the iMessage debacle with Beeper continues. So Apple is playing whack-a-mole with Beeper, and so Beeper fixes it, and then Apple breaks it again, and then Beeper fixes it. Well, we're to broken again, and the dev says they're fighting to get it fixed, whatever that means. So, Steve, Noah eats crow this afternoon. What say you? I told you so?
No, I'm not going to do that. You don't kick somebody when they're down. When you're feeling better, I'll tell you I told you
so. So I'm gonna get a crash course in migrating in migrating Synapse. And at the end of the day, like, I get it. They're overwhelmed. They're trying to right size their company so that they can make all the things work. So I don't want to come off too harsh. But at the same time, like, I think there's a level of you have to understand what it's like to be the customer and be in the client's shoes. And I think when we start to lose touch with that, or when that experience starts to sour, let's not forget there are other competitions in the messaging space. So I think, you know, if you're asking people to go out on an esoteric thing, at least hold their hand while they do it. That would be my ask of them. So I'll let you know. You'll get live updates as it plays out, better, worse, or otherwise. You'll know. And at the end of the day, what I'm parking my hat on is if Slack kicked me off, I would just be done and I would just be screwed because there's nothing I could do. If Discord kicked me off, I'd be screwed. There's nothing I can do because I don't own any of those platforms. There's nothing I can do about it. At least with this, all that's really happening is the instance that I paid them to manage will now move over to another instance that I will manage, but the instance will still be there and I'll still be able to use it and all of the contacts and accounts and everything that I set up, it'll all still work because thank God it can be self-hosted. I was just too lazy to do it and I was happy to pay them to do it, but apparently I don't want to anymore. So that's where we're at with EMS. If you have similar experiences or if you have trouble, write in live at AskNoahShow.com. I will help. Fedora Asahi. The remix has officially landed for Apple Silicon. So this was announced in August and initially planned for the end of the month, but it's finally here. So if you wanted to install Fedora Linux on your Mac Apple Silicon, now is the time to do it. Now, here's the thing. In our pre-production meeting, I said nobody in their right mind would buy a Mac specifically to run Linux on it. And producer JT goes, yeah, where else can you find a laptop with that much RAM? Because the M2s or M3s, whatever it is, they have a ton of RAM, 192 gigs, I think he said. And he's like, where else can you find a laptop like that? So maybe there are some, you know, edge cases to where Silicon Macs work out and that's what you have to have. Here's what I think is really cool. So I sat in a presentation on Asahi Linux at Linux Fest Northwest. And the guy was sitting like in a row behind me and a little bit over to my left. And I'm listening to him and I can hear him kind of muttering, I just copied the script. And within the time of the presentation, he had downloaded the script from Fedora and run the script, and his MacBook turned into a Fedora MacBook in every way that you would expect a Fedora or Fedora to run on a MacBook. The only problem with it was it doesn't have audio because the audio limiters are software built. And so if they were to turn that off and let you use audio, you could potentially turn the volume up too loud and blow out your speakers on your very expensive laptop. So they disable audio, but pass built-in audio. You can use headphones, you can use Bluetooth speaker, whatever. But past that, it's a flawless experience. What I think is really interesting about this is the developers at Apple wanted to make a sustainable product. We know that because they originally, the Asahi people that is, originally had to wrap this inside of a wrapper so that it acted as a big Mac app. And when the developers at Apple found out what was going on, they very quietly changed the firmware so that you could boot alternative operating systems. And it's just kind of a nice nod that, okay, we want to make a sustainable product, even if Apple isn't, after Apple is done supporting it, we still want you to be able to use it. And they're allowing the Asahi folks to do that, which I think is a really cool thing. Quote, experience seamless high DPI support with KDE Plasma builds, even across multiple displays with different display scales, said the Asahi Linux project. With the upcoming improvements to the Wayland ecosystem, we'll be able to support new technologies such as HDR display notches, as well as proper display calibration. I know the answer to this, Steve, but would you ever purchase a Mac to run Linux on it?
I don't know. I mean, in a world where I worked for a business that handed me a Mac for some reason, I totally would do that.
I don't think I could go out of my way to do one, but if like you If it was handed to me or if I had an opportunity on one, I would rather use Linux on it than macOS, I'll tell you that much. Firefox 121 is upon us. So the big news here for Linux users is that Firefox 121 is going to use the Wayland compositor by default instead of X-Wayland. So apart from improving the graphics performance, it's also going to bring things like touchpads and touchscreen gestures and swipe to nav and per monitor DPI, all the fun little things that you would want inside of a web browser running on a on Wayland. The only thing that appears to be a problem is picture-in-picture windows now require extra user interaction, so you're going to have to right-click on the window to get it to pop out from the rest of your Firefox instance. But if you're, are you using Wayland, Steve? Or are you still on X?
Nah, they'll probably X out of my cold, dead hands.
Yeah, I'll put that in the chalkboard right here next to IPv4. Got it. Postmarket OS 23. So this kind of circles back to Micah's question on where we're at in the world of Linux on open source phones. So based on the release of Alpine Linux, Postmarket OS 23.12 is here to introduce new Chromebook devices. So it includes the Samsung Chromebook 11.6-inch, the Samsung Chromebook, Google GRU Chromebook, the Google Kukui Chromebook, the Google Oak Chromebook. I don't know where they come up with these names. The Troger Chromebooks, the Virion, and as well as other Google Chromebooks with 64-bit processor. It also, in this release, has several mobile devices from Xiaomi. They list a bunch of them, the Odroid XU4 single-board computer. They now support a total of 45 devices. The thing that I like about Postmarket OS, it's actually the only operating system that comes out of the box with encryption. Now, previously, the way they were doing that was they had it all set up and you just flash the image onto it. There's obvious security implications there. So the other noteworthy change is that the encrypted installer is working through what they call Unlocker by default. And so NCM, also known as the Network Configuration Manager, is now used by default in the USB networking gadget instead of RNDIS or remote NDIS. Additional safety checks have been made to make sure that the upgrade process is more robust, and the installation images for PinePhone Pro, Librem 5, and the PineBook have been removed. Quote, we provide these as a convenient method to install Postmarket OS encrypted without building your own image. A rewrite of the installer code has been in progress for quite some time with the goal to support more devices and have more automated testing. The new code base is not ready yet, however, due to the regressions in the old code base, it was not feasible to keep the installer images for 23.12. Tekum Peta. He is leading the Open Print Project and a guest this hour on the Ask Noah Show. I got an opportunity to spend some time with Tay at the Ubuntu Summit, and I asked him to give me a look at what printing was like on Linux before he got involved.
I'm Tilkan Peter. I'm leading the Open Printing Project, and with this, I'm responsible for printing and free software. When we had Linux and Unix in former times, up to the late 90s and the beginning of the 2000s, we had the print service named LPD, Line Printer Daemon, and this comes from the time when we had computers, Unix computers, were only mainframes and computing centers, and the printers there were either line printers, these are text-only printers which print like a typewriter more or less, so they can only print letters and characters, fixed letters and characters. And we had laser printers, and they were high-end laser printers which did PostScript. And LPD was the line printer daemon. It comes from the time of the line printer, so they did not need to manage paper trays, fonts, resolutions, and paper types, and so on. So it was simply plain text sent to these printers. The line printer daemon was very rudimentary, did not support the functionality of modern printers. And then we got the laser printers, starting with PostScript printers, and then PostScript established as a standard for graphical content, for formatted text. When there came printers like laser printers with PCL, then one had GhostScript as a PostScript interpreter, GhostScript had built-in output devices, which were pieces of software which converted the incoming PostScript into these formats, mainly PCL and also some bitmap graphics. With the time, we got more and more printers for which print graphical content, but these printers do not do PostScript. We had also the PostScript printers. In any case, we had applications producing graphical content, formatted. We have pages. We have the desire to take paper from one to A1 or to A2 to take paper types and different print qualities and so. And the printers which we had then, which came up more in the 90s, with these one could simply not print with them effectively with LPD anymore, because LPD does not support the control that you can say which paper to A in quality you wanted. System administrators, they came with very weird scripting, and then there came some free software projects like Magic Filter, which did some more systematic printing that the LPD could call GhostScript, and so the GhostScript could generate the format for a PCL laser, for example. If you wanted to print from tray 1 and tray 2, you simply made two print queues, because in Magic Filter, for example, you had to configure each queue and for the queue exactly which command line options have to be passed to GhostScript and so on. This was very, very complicated. Already for system administrators, it was a lot of work. And for end users, for consumers, it was impossible. Such an operating system where printing was this way, one could not really offer to end users. The Linux distributions came up. They were then using things like Magic Filter, but they used a graphical tool like Yast in SUSE, yet another system tool, and it had a printing module, and the printing module was then putting together the scripting for the LPD queues to make it somehow usable, but you still had not the possibility to really control the options of the printer. I was system administrator in a physics department starting 1997 up to the year 2000. And in this time, we had naturally LPD, and we had laser printers, PostScript laser printers with two trays and with front and backside duplex printing, and with these black and white laser printers. So with these laser printers, my predecessors of system administrators made some weird scripting so that one abuses the options of the LPR command, which were for completely different things, which were originally designed for line printers. This way, and then with front-end scripts so that one gets some more user-friendly command line options, they managed it that one could at least to choose the two trays and also choose duplex or not duplex. And this was how we were printing in the department. And then we got a color laser printer, and it came with only proprietary tools for the proprietary Unixes and nothing for Linux. And we had proprietary Unix workstations, there the printer worked well, and we had Linux, and there one could not control this color printer. And this was somehow disappointing.
So Linux was off to a rough start, but thanks to the work of Michael Sweet and Tay Kampeta, eventually CUPS would be released in the early 2000s, and it would not only change the face of printing on Linux, but it would fundamentally provide the framework for things like driverless printing on Linux in the future.
In the beginning of 2000, Michael Sweet has released the version 1.0 of CUPS, and Michael Sweet also has before developed, together with other people, the Internet Printing Protocol, which is a printing communication protocol in networks which is used for CUPS. IPP is the first sophisticated printing protocol. So we have a printing protocol which has very important features. One is that you can send commands, requests to the printer and receive answers. So you can send a request to the printer, the get printer attributes request, and the printer tells you all its capabilities. So it tells you which trays it has, tells you which qualities it offers, with paper sizes it supports, and so on. And it tells you which page description languages, meaning which data formats, it supports for receiving the print jobs. With these possibilities of communication, and also with the case that the client can give commands to the printer when actually a job is sent, like take this tray, do 600 DPI, and so on. With this, one has the full control of a printer, and when the printer is capable of telling all its capabilities, and if it knows one of four standard protocols, then the computer can print on it without needing any printer device model specific software or data, which we also call a driver. We don't need a driver. Is the printer tells everything about itself, and the printer understands page description language, which we can produce.
As a system administrator who spent a lot of time installing print drivers to get various different models printers to work with various different workstations, the idea of driverless printing is hugely appealing to me. But I wanted to understand the underpinnings. How does it actually work? How can you get every manufacturer of every printer to somehow speak the same language?
Naturally, the very first version of IPP did not support driverless printing. It did not have enough sophisticated answer to the get printer attributes request. And also, there was no agreement between printer manufacturers by way of printer working group on which protocols we use as standard protocols for the print data. IPP was further developed in the version 2.0. We had everything for driverless printing. Michael Sweet, he did not only initiate the development of IPP, he created the printing system CUPS, called Common Unix Printing System. He wanted to make a free software printing system for all kinds of Unix, Linux, and similar operating systems, and one which is more modern, which gives the users control on the printer. As we were still with IPP 1.0, which did not do driverless printing, we did not even have developed in that time standardized raster printing formats. PostScript is our standard printing format because in that time, for printers who do graphical formatted printing, PostScript was a standard in the computing centers. For the other printers which do not PostScript, we have GhostScript. And so he said, we take the PPD files, the PostScript printer description files, as a standard to tell which capabilities a printer has. As PostScript printers come with a PPD file by the manufacturer. And for the non-PostScript printers, Michael Sweet told, we do our own PPD files. We add a special line to the PPD file telling which filter the printer needs to turn PostScript into the printer's format. And the filter was a program which, for example, could call GhostScript. With this way, CUPS could also support the non-PostScript printers, and this was what Mike introduced. And the PostScript printer description file, the PPD, contains all the capabilities. It contains the paper trays, the paper sizes, the paper types, the resolutions, and so on. And based on this information, one can once send by command line print jobs accompanied with all the options and settings so that one can control the printer. One could write a print dialog, which also used the PPD file, which showed exactly in the graphical user interface the user settable options which a user could set along with a job to print and to control the printer, to say double-sided, second tray, 600 DPI, and so on. It was easy to make such a print dialog. I have done one because there was no free print dialog. There was CUPS in mid-2000, but no free software print dialog. And so I've done one, and I needed something like 10 days for it, and I released as free software.
I asked Tay about raster formats, essentially an image format that allows the computer to communicate exactly what it wants the printer to print. There are a number of different competing ways to do this, and they all have their advantages and disadvantages depending on how powerful the printer is. But this is where it was really fascinating to talk with somebody who has been doing this for so many years and really understands the insides and outs of something like the printing subsystem in Linux.
There are four print data formats. Important is naturally when you have a printer and want to print on it without a driver, without any software or information which is specific to the printer model, you need standard formats in which you send the job data to the printer. One of the standard formats is PDF. For the sophisticated printers, they can send vector graphics, scalable graphics, vector graphics, formatted text, fonts, pictures, and so on to the printer. The printer rasterizes this internally, turns this internally into pixels, which are put down on the paper with toner. But PDF is a sophisticated, complex format. And if you want to build a printer, which you want to sell for $40 in the supermarket, you cannot have a PDF interpreter in it. The computational power of the printer is not high enough. It has not enough RAM, and it has not a processor which is powerful enough. So we need also standard formats to be able to construct a cheaper printer. So we need raster formats. We have three raster formats, perhaps something historical, because Apple wanted to get very quickly driverless printing going, and so they made also their own flavor of it, and so they created their own raster format. So we have raster format is a bitmap data format, so every page is represented by the pixels which get printed and not by the letters or by lines or so on, but by the actual pixels, like a photo is also a file which is composed of the pixels which make up the photo. These raster formats, in contrary to photo formats like JPG and PNG, they must also support carrying more than one page, as a usual print job has often several pages. So Apple has quickly done one raster format called Apple Raster, because they wanted to get their iPhones to print. And the iPhones should not carry, because they are limited in storage space, tons of PPD files, drivers, and so on. And so Apple was very much after driverless printing. Another graphical format, the printer working group by themselves, they have also developed free and open standards which everyone can use and which we can use under Linux, for example, also, because they are free and open, they are published. And in as part of this standard, they have also created a raster format. They have derived it from the CUPS raster format, which Michael Sweet has put into the very first CUPS as a format, which GoScript outputs and which driver filters take as input, so that GoScript and the driver filters are decoupled and not the driver filters built into GoScript anymore, as it was in former times. And this was really a nightmare for the distribution, because the distributions had to put many, many drivers which were contributor patches into the GoScript, and when there was a new GoScript, then the maintainer of the GoScript package had so much work to port the drivers into the next GoScript. The printer working group, PWG, has derived a little bit simplified format named PWG Raster, and this is the second of the raster formats in the standard. Printer manufacturers have also said we take PDF and we make the PDF simpler. We do a reduced PDF, which only is a bitmap format, which is not a vector graphics format anymore. So no fonts, no lines, and no letters, and so on. And this they called PCLM. But be careful, PCLM is not PCL. PCL is an HP printer command language for their laser printers. And this language has nothing to do with PDF, but PCLM is a simplified raster-only PDF. And this is the third format. It was in the beginning proprietary and was only published later. And so there are three raster formats. And these three understand it, and this makes up for. And driverless printing is, in all cases, independent how it is called and whether it's from Apple or so, it's all the time working the same way. The printer itself tells by DNSSD, advertises itself in the network. The computers in the network can find the printers by these advertisings, and then they talk to the driverless printer IPP, and the first thing what they do, they send an IPP get printer attributes request, and then the printer tells them about their capabilities. With this, the client, the computer, knows which format it has to generate, which data format it has to generate, and it knows also which options and settings it has to display in the print dialogues so that the user can control the printer. The user clicks on print, and then the application sends PDF to CUPS, and CUPS converts the PDF to the format the printer needs. There are only four which there can be, so it's easy that we can carry all the filters for that. And then the printer receives it along with the settings which the user has selected, and the job gets printed. Every common, usual printer, so no legacy or specialty printers, the printers we can buy in the big box electronic stores or simply in our supermarket, they are driverless. Especially manufacturers' motivation is that we can also print with from our phone on them. So this means the printer's driverless, so they all print principally with Linux. There can be some better or worse implementations of driverless, but most manufacturers now do a good implementation of driverless.
We always say in this program that Linux is a first-class citizen, so in my visit with Tay, I was, of course, wanting to know who he recommended to buy printers from. He said that most of the printers now support driverless printing, so there wasn't reason to buy it based on compatibility, but some of the fine print in the way that printer manufacturers deal with their ink and the way they treat their end users might influence your decision.
And so we have to look at other criteria, the robustness of the hardware, and also how the manufacturer is treating the user in terms of toner and ink. Because toner and ink can be very, very expensive. The manufacturer earns by toner and ink and not by the printer. They often sell printers with a loss, as a so-called loss leader. They do tricks, firmware tricks, like you have a printer scanner multifunction device and you run out of toner, and when the toner is empty, the printer refuses to scan. You don't need toner for scanning normally, but the printer by firmware refuses to scan. This is the way how the manufacturer wants to trick the user into buying ink. There are also ink subscription models. The manufacturer wants to drive the user into an ink subscription model. So get the comfort of always having ink. We are counting your pages. By that, we know when you are getting out of ink, and we send ink to you. I know that many HP and Canon printers, I know it from complaints of users, are there who refuse to scan when they are out of ink or toner. And for example, when you have a Brother printer, they do not bother so much. Their business is more they sell you a good printer and let you print and scan with it, and do not try so much to press on you to buy new ink and toner. And also they have well implemented the driverless printing, and therefore they turned out the most recommended one. I've heard several of my colleagues here at Canonical and also on recent threads on Mastodon that they have bought Brother printers and they are very, very content with them. One thing I want to say, I'm very often on conferences due to the fact that I'm leading open printing, and on each conference there are at least three or four people who are praising my work, telling how well printing works, and very often it even happens that someone tells me that printing works better than under Windows or Mac.
Tay Kompeta with the Open Print Project, and a guest this hour on the Ask Noah Show. Tay, I thank you for taking the time to visit with me at the Ubuntu Summit. We'll get you out of the program again soon. The music in our ears means we're out of time. I thank you for joining us. If we record this show every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Central, you can find it at AskNoahShow.com. If you missed part of the show, you're wondering, what is he talking about? He mentioned that thing, or talked about that project, or told me to go research that. Well, it's all available for you at podcast.AskNoahShow.com. There you'll find not only the articles and references we used to make the show, but all the stuff we didn't have time to get to in the show. The entire back catalog is there as well. We're on X, also known as Twitter, at Ask Noah Show. I'm at Colonel Linux. He's at Linux Evans. We're back next week, next Tuesday, 6 p.m. Central, AskNoahShow.com. Have a good week.